World War II, a time of unrelenting global trauma, stretching from 1939 to 1945. It involved all of the great powers of the time. It was the most destructive episode in the history of civilization. It required its major forces to dedicate their entire military, economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities to the cause of warfare. Estimates of the death toll vary, from 50 million to 85 million worldwide. World War II took the art of war to new and appalling heights through massacre, genocide, remorseless bombing raids, starvation, disease, and the first use of nuclear weapons. The final story in this collection of World War II memories is told by Albert Norman, known as Bert, Ward. He was born in 1919, the son of a World War I veteran who'd been gassed. Through his small pension and work as a labourer and as a bootmaker, he brought in just enough money every week to keep the family going. Bert himself helped out by finding a job selling newspapers. They were tough times, but unquestionably character-forming.
We got by just. And my memory goes back to the days of rations, when you actually physically got rations, not money. And walking from Kensington, first of all, to Kintore Avenue, picked up the groceries, and here it was. Look, I've got no recollection, clear recollection, of events and ages or things like that, but I was probably 8 or 9, carried a sugar bag, and my father also carried a sugar bag. And these sugar bags, back in those days, nothing was pre-packaged like today in our supermarkets. The grocer, if he got a request or an order for sugar, well, he'd weigh out 1 or 2 pounds of sugar at the time. And so this happened with everything. For instance, biscuits all came loose, and they came from the manufacturers in tins, quite large tins, and so were weighed up whether a quarter pound of biscuits or half pound or 1 pound, as the case may be. And so, anyway, everyone was looking for the lowest possible price. There was not the score of bargains like it is nowadays, because I would say that almost all saleable items were down at a bottom price, so there wasn't much competition based on price alone.
Now, your recollections are remarkably clear. You have an extensive vocabulary, if I may say so. You express yourself most lucidly. Clearly, you had a good, sound education. Tell me about your school, where you went and what it was like.
Well, although I have no memory of it, my first schooling was, in effect, a preschool, a church hall, St. Matthew's Church Hall, out of Kensington, just a little away from the St. Matthew's Church, an Anglican church. But from then onwards, it was a matter of ordinary public school for a short time, when living at Hackney for a while, going to the East Adelaide Public School, and went back in them, well, what is broadly the Norwood or Kensington area, to the Norwood School. And so...
And I believe that to supplement the family income, you actually sold newspapers. You were out in the street.
Well...
How much did you earn from that?
Well, I think I started at 8 years of age, selling newspapers. And this was after school, 5 days a week. And so this was the Adelaide News. And so most of my time was at the Norwood Town Hall, which was a good position because that was an end of a section. You paid your tram fee, by sections, two or three or four, according to whichever route you were on. And so the newspaper in those days, Adelaide newspaper, was tuppence halfpenny, two and a half pence,
yes.
But 2 pence was always tuppence.
Yes, I know.
T-U-P-P-E-N-C-E. And so, on occasion, I suppose it might have averaged once a week, I might have got a halfpenny tip.
Yes.
Someone gave me sovereigns and said, keep the tip. And so I'd go home quite proud of the fact I'd got a halfpenny tip. And so, but that, from what I can very vaguely recall, I think I averaged for 5 nights a week, and from late afternoon fairly, it varied according to the weather circumstances and time of the year, say 6:30, but virtually by that time all the normal shops had closed. All the workers and the office workers had left at, say, 5 or 5:30. And so, of course, it was pointless. Mm. Stopping to try to sell newspapers later in the evening. And so, now that was for 5 nights a week, and you'd finish up with a wage for the week. And I seem to recall fairly clearly an average of about 1 and 2 pence, 1 shilling and 2 pence. That's 14 pence, and which would be 13-14 cents.
Mm.
That's for a week's work.
Enough, though, to buy a couple of dinners for the family, I guess.
Well, it all helped, and at least out of it, I'd have my 1 penny, and might be occasionally 2 pennies, to hire a magazine. Now, in those days, virtually every suburb had a bookshop, and second-hand magazines of all types. And the point was, you came along with a booklet or whatever it may have been, and swapped it. And it was more of a swap, and you were paying a penny then for the opportunity of getting a different magazine or whatever it may be.
What were your favourite magazines? What did you like to hire?
Oh, there were things called, we don't say things, that's wrong. There were boys' magazines, The Gem, The Magnet, that's two that come to mind, but there were several. And so these were all printed, written and printed in England, and of course featured English upper class boys at these private schools.
I think they had Billy Bunter, didn't they? People like that. Billy Bunter, the fat owl of the Remove.
Yes. I think he was in the Magnet. I wouldn't be sure about
right.
that. And so, but additionally, we were youngsters. Was in the library, and strangely enough, and I don't know now the reason for it, but it was the St. Peter's Library. So we walked from Kensington or Norwood over to St. Peter's to change our free library books.
Now, but this had to end, though. You had to take a job, a full-time job. You had to leave school, 13, 14.
Yeah.
Economic circumstances forced this. What sort of job did you get?
Well, Ed, I was 13 at the time, and my father saw an advert in a shopfront in the Norwood, what is now, not Norwood, in what is now the Rundle Mall. But of course it was all part of Rundle Street in those days. And saying that there was a job available for a boy. Well, this opened up the world. He came home. I didn't go to school next day. Off we walked into town, interviewed the manager of this shop, which was a warehouse, a name which you may recall, Sampson Cycle Stores. And in those days, they ran a very large postal service for country clients. And so my job varied from number one, well, mailing out these catalogues, and so or going out, going to the printers for blocks, and really it was an interesting job, plus the fact that every afternoon taking parcels down to the Adelaide railway station for putting on to passenger trains, because most of the small articles, really small, were sent to the country by passenger train.
I believe you had to work long hours. I'm told it was even 48 hours a week.
Oh, no. It was 52 hours a week. 52 hours a week for 10 shillings a week, the equivalent of $1. And so it was an interesting job. And quite frankly, when I started there, I was still in short pants. A small little runt of an individual. And so...
But this actually changed your life, because you were working for a cycle shop. And you yourself, I believe, became pretty good at cycling.
I think that might be gilding the lily a little bit. I did become a professional racing cyclist, and I like cycling, and so I enjoyed the racing, and so everything that went with cycle racing in those days.
And the money would have been useful? The money from the cycling would have been useful?
Oh, well, yes. But the money was very limited. It wasn't much more than a sweepstakes. Okay. Yeah. And it was just simply a matter. I know in the early stages, I started off with my first race, I was 5, next race 4, next race 3, yeah, next race 2. Oh, and I was... thinking, well, I had to win it, and I got pipped on the post, and I got another second. But at that stage, I was 18. Apparently, I don't know whether it was official or not, or whether it was just taken as an easy guide, but they took lads as from 18. And, of course, I did not have a real racing cycle. Yes. I had a semi-racing cycle.
Where were those races held in those days, Bert?
From the various hotels, the Northern Hotel at Prospect, or the Reapham Hotel out at Islington, even from the Fountain Inn on Glen Osmond Road. And the Glind Hotel was one of our regulars.
And what sort of distance did you have to cover in these races? How many miles were they?
The most I think I ever did was 70 miles. So miles, not kilometres in those days, of course. And so I certainly got better as I got a little older. And, of course, they were all handicap races. And so each time you won a few shillings, well, you paid for them because you went towards the back.
I got you.
Mm-hmm. And yet, for all intents and purposes, I don't think the money played much part in my thinking, except the fact that it was nice to know you got your 2 shillings back if you got a place in.
So we've come now well into the 1930s.
Yeah.
War is brewing in Europe. Yeah. War is declared 1939. Yeah. Can you remember what you were doing, where you were, what your life was like at the time of the outbreak of war?
No. After a matter of, say, about 4 or 5 months, something like that, I changed jobs. And then I got with a firm, a paint and glass firm. Now, I was somehow or other, I started off as a delivery boy, office boy, come everything, and so it was just simply a matter you learned and I was able to cope with limited instructions with whatever was needed at any particular minute. And so the first part of it, and the major part, and how I started the job, was delivering invoices, because that saved on the postage.
Yes.
And so it quickly proved that it was a financial advantage to the firm. Although in those days, I'm not sure it was a penny or tuppence was the postage. So, but by the same token, I'd get them do the round of whatever happened, whatever invoices were needed that day. And this covered the square mile of Adelaide. And so, all said and done, that.
Now, war broke out 39,
yeah.
And you enlisted in 1940, but I understand you particularly wanted to serve in the Air Force rather than the Army.
Yes.
Why was that, and why didn't the Air Force work out?
First of all, virtually every lad and every young man had a fair idea of some of the worst facts of World War One, and so they weren't, well, the great majority weren't too keen on just simply being part of the infantry, the PBI, as it was called. Mm. Poor bloody infantry.
And your father had been in the infantry and had been gassed on the Western Front, so
that's
you
right.
Really knew about it.
Although he never spoke about it, yet by the same token, you couldn't be unaware of his hard time, and you weren't looking forward to do the same. Whereas the appeal of flying an aeroplane was something that had the overwhelming percentage of young men keen. But of course, with no educational background, they wouldn't accept my name. And so this went on. I made many physical contacts by going to the Air Force enrollment and being rebuffed, and no other words for it. And so this more or less quietened down me, and right through until into 1940, when of course France was quickly overrun, and as you would know, May, June, July, it was a hopeless proposition. France was well and truly beaten. I won't comment it anyway at all. Only private opinions about, the bad management. There are better words, I suppose. Bad management of their conduct of the war at that particular time. And so I felt, England was really in terrible danger, and that I should, without question, do my bit to help. Now, I must say that at that time, it was not only universal thought that all young men should go to war, but you accepted it yourself. It was into your own thinking, this is what is expected of me, and I will do what I can. And so that started a period when I was wasting more time contacting the Air Force and got nowhere. And so how in August of 1940 I joined up the AIF.
And you became SX 9994, Private Wood of the 2nd 27th That's Battalion. Right. And you trained at Woodside. What was that like?
You see, what did transpire, most people are not aware or fully aware of this, is that conscription started as from January the 1st, 1940. And so all men who became the age of 21, June, of course, of that calendar year, they were called up. There's no question about it at all. And some got reservation jobs, but most people just simply had to serve their time. Didn't matter what they were, what the jobs were, whatever the young man was, he was called up. Now, because my birthday happened to fall in May, right, I went in for the 6 months continuous training in that period, January the 1st, June the 30th. Those whose birthdays fell from July the 1st to December the 31st went in the second half of the war. And so what with that training up at Woodside for some months, and I can't say now 2, 3, 4 months, plus the fact that after that is continual on the job training, you had weekly drill hall duties, and in my case it was down at Alberton.
Right. Now, you told me, I understand that you were just, as one would expect, in the infantry, a rifleman at first, but later, specialist Bren gun. How did that come about, and why were you selected for this?
Well, I think it was just simply a matter that during the fighting in the Middle East, and this was a Syrian campaign, well, because of my background as a professional racing cyclist, I had the strength of my legs, and I could keep going when some of the others very hard, and so I don't think I was ever a better Bren gunner than the next person, but at least I could carry the Bren gun, which was 27 pounds in weight, and so as compared to a Lee Enfield 303, which was 9 pounds in weight. And so it was just simply a matter, I wasn't asked, I didn't volunteer, I was just told it, okay.
So you heave the Bren gun up your shoulder and you just kept going.
Yeah, that's it. You just did what you were told. That was one of the things that could happen in those days. I think much more easily done than could ever happen nowadays. You did what you were told. You went where you were sent.
Now, where were you sent? Because after basic training at Woodside, you had to go somewhere else and get ready for overseas service. What happened next?
No, not for us South Australians. No, all that ever happened was that in January 1941, in the first, might have been the first week, I don't know, but it was certainly early in January 41, well, put on a troop train to Melbourne, went down to Port Melbourne, got on the ship there, the Mauritania, and so in those days the Atlantic liners were the major troop carriers because they were fast and they could outdo well, certainly all submarines, but outdo many warships. And so it was something, well, it was hoped, and as far as I know, it worked out quite well. These liners were used for the long ocean voyages, and then at port you were transshipped from the liner to a smaller coastal type boat to your final destination.
So where did the Mauritania take you? What happened next?
Through, first of all, Sri Lanka, or of course Ceylon in those days, and then to Bombay. And at Bombay we transshipped into another boat, a Dutch ship, a smaller, basically a cargo boat, and to Egypt. And so it meant that every time you was on a ship that you was in danger because of these raiders. The Germans had a couple of raiders, but well,
what was your first experience, Bert, of coming under fire of active service?
Well, first of all, I think you'd have to have some idea of the fact that the adrenaline starts flowing purely because of the fact you're on really active service, and you're committed, and you just simply take it for granted, and you don't want to be shown up as not being able to cope, not being able to do your job properly, and so it depends on it. But I was in Syria, two old-fashioned World War I type bayonet charges. Now, if there's any to help you grow up fast, by gee, is to be in a bayonet charge. Well, the first time was extremely fortunate. Oh, I think in the panic, the opposition forgot to alter the lower their sights on their machine guns.
This was the Vichy French?
Vichy French. Look, I'll just depart for a moment here because it needs a bit of explaining for most people. As I understand, and of course it was not well known and certainly not publicised at all, was that when France fell, Hitler came to an arrangement with the Vichy government people, Pétain and some of the others involved, was that if you take active steps to prevent any of your territories or equipment or personnel falling into Allied hands, well, at the end of the war, we will give you back all your French colonial possessions. Now, the biggest card trick you could imagine. But I suppose the French felt, well, what could they do? They had no option. And this was at least something to go out, get a check as being in their favour as to why they came to such a quick surrender to the Germans. And so that was the point.
You were in this old-fashioned, as you put it, bayonet charge. Oh. And can you describe, did you take part in hand-to-hand fighting, hand-to-hand combat? You saw the eyes of the enemy?
Well, the first charge we were in, we down a slight slope in the hills and then up a fairly steep slope. But apparently the enemy, the French Foreign Legion, and there's the point in that, they realised there was no future stopping where they were, and off they went. And so by the time we got to their machine guns, they had very few men there. Most of them were going over the horizon. So that was... although we had lost a certain amount of men because of the machine guns hammering away as we were running towards them, quite frankly, there was nothing there. They were surrendering, and I feel that the French Foreign Legion had a very bad hand dealt to them. The point was that, as I've more or less assumed, was that the Germans didn't trust them. The French didn't want them because there was a mixture of all sorts, and so many of them were not the right sorts that people would want. And so they were used as, well, cannon fodder or just simply as dispensable.
I have to ask, did you actually get to use your bayonet?
No, no, except for opening up tins of bully beef.
But thank you. Now, the Vichy French campaign, the Syrian campaign, was a short but bloody one, high casualties, yeah. But you came out of that. Where did you go next? Did you have to go back on the ship and get transported somewhere else?
No, we were just simply kept in the Middle East because it was not knowing what the move it would make next. And, of course, that move was landing in Libya and from there on was, well, mostly centred around Tobruk. Well, my first part in the 1941 was the what we called, for want of a better name or terminology, the Egyptian Western Desert Campaign. And so, in effect, Tobruk was on the western side of the border. We were on the eastern side in Egypt in case Rommel did break through into Egypt. But Rommel was caught inasmuch as he dare not leave. It was only the one road for his heavy equipment, his heavy artillery and tanks and what have you, to get from Libya through to Egypt. And so this was, it was an interesting time, but we was at, well, close to the border, but I can't quote how many miles, but most of our fighting as such, it was confined to the score of air raids, but of mainly Italian Air Force. But the Italian Air Force would come over at a terrific height, and of course, by the time that any Allied plane could take off and circle to get up and up there, the Italians were 100 miles away. But there was quite a bit of bombing, but oh, look, from the height that they were doing their bombing, they wouldn't have known within a mile where the bombs were likely to drop. Within a mile.
And so there was the Siege of Tobruk, the Battles of El Alamein, and eventually the North African campaign was over. What happened to you next?
Well, it was thought by the world powers that be that Hitler may invade the area which is broadly called Palestine,
yes.
And attack the Suez Canal from the north. And so, knowing that the French weren't going to help him in any way at all, they were out of the war completely. What they did, had a lot of French Foreign Legion people there. And so we left Egypt and travelled up into Syria. And in those days, Lebanon was a province of Syria. And so it was not called the Lebanese project or Lebanese campaign or anything like that, but most of the Australians were in Lebanon, and that was given their own nationhood in 43, well after we were there in 41, And this is one of the things where I suppose most Lebanese themselves don't even realise it now, that they became a separate nation because the Australians had more or less opened up the whole thing for them.
Now, there was a lot of troop movement going on, Australian forces en masse being sent elsewhere, being recalled to Australia. Some were sent disastrously to Java and were imprisoned as a result of that. But you, yourself, you actually did get back to Australia.
Yes, ultimately. Well, we did honestly think the odds we were coming back to Australia. And so we all came down from the Syrian area to Egypt, ready for shipping. And but instead of that, well, first of all, we were shipped to Bombay, on a little coastal vessel. Well, it was a large coastal vessel, but a cargo boat. But they had the grand title, City of London. But it was a tram ship, basically. But we didn't know that at the time there was this verbal battle between Churchill and Curtin. And I will give him full marks, because apparently he wanted the Australians back here in Australia, and Churchill had the complete control because he had complete control of shipping. And so it didn't matter how much Sir Curtin might have raved on, he wasn't going to get his troops. And so off we went, firstly from Egypt to India, and then continuing on until we got within what I understand from what one of the seamen involved on the boat was able to tell someone, and quickly got round. We were within one day's sailing of Singapore when the information came through. Turn around, we don't want you here. Now, it was too late, you see.
Singapore, February 1942, had fallen.
Yes, and so, of course, they wanted empty ships for transporting, to evacuate people from Singapore, not more troops. And this is how it is. The second, third machine gunners, the South Australian unit, they were captured later, because as they were, well, presumably turned around, they weren't in the same convoy as us or anything like that, but it was indication of how disjointed everything was, how haphazard it was all. They had their equipment and their heavy Vickers guns on a different ship, not on the ship on which they were sailing.
What about your ship? Actually made it back to Australia, is that right?
Well, yes. First of all, we was going to go to either one of the destinations was Rangoon, mm-hmm. One was to be Batavia. So we were dodging around that area, going to go to A, and then being turned around to go to B, turned around to go to C, until finally it was decided they were running out of ports that they could even call at. And so we went back to Sri Lanka. And from then, and because at that time, as I know, probably the only thing they had left on there in the boat was, well, not the only thing, but certainly the predominant thing was potatoes. And so we made it back to Sri Lanka, so we must have got certain amount of foodstuffs there, and then, of course, came back to Fremantle.
But there was something else in store for you, namely New Guinea. And got there later in 1942, I understand, towards the end of 1942.
Yes, but it wasn't until August 42. First of all, we were in a coastal guard, I suppose you could call it, for want of any better description, in Queensland. As it happened, within the so-called Brisbane Line. Now, that was a well-known expression in those days. But in effect, the Brisbane Line started north of Brisbane, much where my battalion was camped, Caloundra, roughly 50 miles north of Brisbane, and came down all the way through Newcastle to Sydney, because it was all that length of coastal area where it was expected would be a major Japanese invasion force. But what had been happening in the meantime is that the, particularly the American Air Force, but certainly helped by the Australian Air Force, had been creating havoc with Japanese shipping. And so the end of so much of their shipping, end of their lines of communication with shipping, finished about Rabaul. And so there was a terrifically large encampment there at Rabaul of Japanese troops. But then there was the trouble of reinforcing them and getting foodstuffs to them. And so, as I understand it, the major factor involved was growing enough produce, such as vegetables, to look after their troops at Rabaul, let alone get them to anywhere else, such as New Guinea, or even vaguely possible Australia.
Now, I understand we were having a bit of a talk before our interview today, and you are one of the famous men who had to take to the Kokoda Track.
Yeah.
I take you that time when you got to New Guinea, the 2nd 27th Battalion was effectively cut off, had to jungle bash their way to the coast, and in time of incredible hardship. What did you eat? How did you survive?
Well, look, it's something that's is difficult to convey to people. How ignorance helps you. You don't get dispirited because you know you're facing, well, what appear, particularly in retrospect, insurmountable opposition. But first of all, we arrived in New Guinea in, I think, August the 14th, certainly August 1941. 42. Well, at that time, considering the Japs had landed at Gona back in June, that's, well, there'd been a bit of a gap period, and so I could understand how there'd been wishful thinking by the Australian Army headquarters. Well, we've got some militia troops up there, and these were all really untrained, unfit people, and you couldn't have picked a worse place in the islands for malaria except Port Moresby. It was notorious. Has been the hellhole of the Southwest Pacific for malaria, because it's on a flat coastal plain and the mountains rearing up on the outskirts, and the Owen Stanley Ranges, range after range after range of troops. You up one, you go up one, down one, up one, and describe, I think fairly appropriately, as being like the sawtooth. Saw these ups and downs, and no pathways or passageways, call them what you like, certainly no roadways in any part of it. And so the road finishes out of Port Moresby in the first, well, up range on the outskirts. And so
can I take you back to that time? There you were, you had to climb these Owen Stanleys, yeah. You had to take to the Kokoda track. You were eating grass and leaves, I believe.
Oh, yes. But that was later. This is when we were going into the attack, yes. And why we were there. And so, first of all, when the Japanese arrived, well, their beachhead was Gona. And so they spent quite a bit of time just simply preparing and fortifying areas in the Gona district before they made their move up to Kokoda. Now, I can only say I'm very vague on this, but I believe Kokoda is about 20 miles inland from the actual beachhead itself. And so from then onwards, well, of course, the fighting started. And so the very few, Australian CMF troops, CMF stands for Citizen Military Forces, but yet were generally referred to as militia. And so they in the main, they did a good job.
But what about you? What did you have to experience? What were you going through at this time?
Well, the point comes in, it's not easy to... it's easy enough to say it, but yet a very... difficult to truly convey to most people that feeling of commitment that you had mentally made. You'd do the damn best because you were fighting for your country. Now, we weren't to know after New Guinea what the Japs would do next, and we took it for granted certainly would be an invasion of Australia.
What was it like for you physically, carrying your Bren gun, living off the land such as it was? Can you paint that picture for me, what you were eating, how you were surviving, how you managed to keep going with this remarkable endurance in this rugged terrain.
Well, it was the fact that basically the training we'd had and the actual fighting that we'd had in the Middle East, which had fitted us, because there's the common army description, toughen up. Well, we'd been toughened up to a point where you weren't aware of it in one sense, but yet physically it had been done. That made you coarser. Now, that may seem a strange word under the circumstances, but yet was there. You could live in circumstances where even a matter of 6 months, 12 months earlier, you would have really turned your nose up at. But you, that way you'd been conditioned to really stand a lot of privations and make do and cope.
Privations were severe. The climate for a start, disease, and then this lack of food. And it is correct, isn't it? You were actually eating grass. You were actually eating leaves.
Yes. I don't know.
And can you describe that to
me? A little bit of a suspicion that some of the chaps might have somehow or other... I don't know, can't even hazard a guess, and got hold of a tin of bully beef and put in their gear or a packet of biscuits or something. But anyway, that would only last for a short time.
I mean, what was it like trying to eat grass, trying to eat leaves? Can you describe that to me?
You just chew it and chew it and ultimately spit out what you can't swallow. I think what helped me was a personal knowledge that I'd read in a book, and I was an omnivorous reader as a young person, was that the score that the Chinese peasants during times of drought and complete famine, they would even eat or swallow mud.
Yeah.
Just dirt and water. And the whole idea of that was to have something passing through their systems. Now, to the average person, it seems crazy, and yet there's a certain amount of logic. And so these ignorant peasants knew how to survive a real famine period.
Clearly you were philosophically attuned to survival, but against that was the fact that you had the enemy firing at you, Japanese snipers, and the fatality rate was very high.
Yeah. Well, you never thought about fatalities. You were there to do a job, and if you weren't able to do it, well, you'd done your part. And so you weren't trying to assess things in a normal sort of a way. And so it's not easy to answer that question, but you had been... to some extent, it seems an odd statement, but it's almost you'd brainwash yourself.
Now, looking at you now, I have to convey to people who might be listening to this interview that I can see an indentation and a scar on the top of your head. How'd you get that?
Well, I was making an attack one morning. Actually, it was the second morning at this particular area at Gona. And the first day, well, the person in charge had fortunately called out, retire. You don't use the word retreat. Retire sounds so much more honourable. But anyway, so the first day gave us an indication by crikey, they were well entrenched, the Japs were well entrenched, and by crikey, you don't know quite how you could handle this one, because in effect, it needed artillery to get them out of some of their encamped areas.
So what happened to you? Was it a sniper?
I was walking, and one of the first things you learn is not to get involved in small groups, because one machine gun magazine might take out every one of those people in that group. And so I was on my own. I was certainly within calling distance and at times within sight of others, but not alongside them. None of the shoulder-to-shoulder business. You had to be individual, and because you didn't know quite where you were going or where the enemy were.
Had you been warned about snipers?
No. No, on that score, on the sniper angle, onto a different area, and I'll come back to it later, this is where the Australian military top brass, they didn't make use of Bennett's. Of Singapore.
Gordon Bennett, yes. But I'm interested, and this is the important thing to tell your story, you were shot. Was that a machine gun wound, or was that a sniper?
Yeah. Now, my eyes were very firmly fixed on the ground, because the Japs, they may have on occasion... with some of their light machine guns, they might have been firing from the hip. But I would say, and an assumption on my part, admittedly, was they were almost always lying on the ground, doing it at ground level, and as they were prone behind their gun. And so I'm looking down to see if any movement of undergrowth, eyes firmly fixed down at a low point, and not for the life of me thinking of looking up the trees, and it would have cast, wouldn't have even had the faintest thought of thinking of snipers, and yet it was something that did cause a lot of casualties.
Can you describe for me the time you were hit, what you can remember about it?
First of all, I was leaning forward somewhat, because when you're firing a Bren gun from the hip, the weight of it is such that would tend to make you that way, to be leaning forward, finger on the trigger, and ready to let burst go with any movement. Could have been, say, an animal, it could have been anything, but could have been a Japs. So anyway, when I got hit, although I was leaning forward, I toppled right back. My whole body, plus the weight of my machine gun, completely backwards. And so I didn't have that sensation of falling. I wouldn't have known that I'd fallen except I had this crazy thought, gee, I'm dead, because everything was black. Everything completely black. And there was no sounds penetrated to me. I had absolutely no feeling of any sort whatsoever in those first few minutes. Wouldn't have known whether I had arms or legs or anything, because there was no part of me, my brain working, to telling me what may or may not have occurred. And so, anyway, after a certain time, measured in minutes, there was started to be light, a little bit of light flashing, and then became a kaleidoscope of colour, all the colours of the rainbow, and then that eased out to blue and green. And the crazy thought went through my mind, this heaven's a beautiful place. And there it is. I'm flat on my back, looking up through the trees, seeing part of the sky on occasion and part of the trees waving. And there was my blue and green, and I'm looking up at it. And so from then onwards, my brain started working fairly quickly, and I realised my lower, well, from roughly the waist downwards, was completely paralysed, both legs, and yet I could feel I had my upper body and my arms and hands. And so the second thought was, hell, get out of here. Because naturally enough, not knowing what had hit me or where it had come from or anything at all like that, but I knew that I'd been belted hard, without realising it was just simply a bullet had actually hit me. And fortunately I had a thick skull, and I've been careful about not using the word thick-headed. I had a thick skull, and what had transpired is that the bullet had smashed my skull and then ricocheted off. But in the process, as it smashed my skull, had certainly played havoc with my brain and with the brain's ability to control things. And so I realised, well, the best thing is for to get out of here. And I struggled, and I just purely with my hands and elbows, I turned over onto my front, and I started getting out with my elbows. And I found, surprisingly, how well I could move, although I finally I had no idea of time factor, no idea of distance. I moved to the extent, I suppose, I went at least 200 yards, 200, of course, yards in those days, not metres. And I'd stumbled, pure luck, onto the RAP. That's the Regimental Aid Post. Now, it was no more or less than luck, because all I knew, I had to go north, and if any, a little bit northwest. And so, here it is, I'd travelled, and by some incredible fate, it got to the RAP. If I hadn't done that, I might have continued struggling. No help from my legs. I was dragging them behind. All the traction was coming from my elbows and a limited amount by grabbing sometimes the grass of a bush or even the base of a tree with my hands, but almost all my forward motion was done with the elbows. And so at this RAP there was one chap there, and half a dozen wounded chaps, all very well well and truly well begone, and so he couldn't do anything more than sprinkle the dome of my head with a powder. Sulfamilamide sticks in my name, but I don't know whether I got the name right. But it was it's kind of a dust or powder which he just sprinkled on, and then I put a dressing on top of that. And so this is what it was, that I just simply laid there for hours, and then the other chaps started talking amongst themselves and to get out of it, because they didn't know quite well what would be the next step, whether it'd be anyone to help them out. Best thing was see, get out themselves. And so there might have been some coming and going, and the numbers of more casualties coming in. And so, candidly, I can't say much on that, because I just don't know.
But you must have got medical attention eventually. Oh, how did that come about?
Well, off we went. About a half a dozen of us.
But how you say off you went, but you couldn't walk, is that right?
Well, I could. Now, one leg had come fairly good. Right. One leg was definitely still paralysed. And so what this chap did for me, this RAP chap, he'd got hold of a heavy stick, which I could use as a, some means of a staff. And so, now this might have been late morning, and from then onwards, until it was just getting dark, the twilight, which is very, very short in the tropics, well, another 10 minutes might have seen me out. Anyway, we got to near Popandetta. And so from them onwards, I don't know quite whether they picked me up and took me in or what it was, but it was a medical aid post. And they put me on a slab of, they'd made some sort of a rough table used as a operation table. And what had they done was they had operated to release the blood in the brain.
Tell me about your recovery and the repatriation to Australia.
Well, first of all, at Popandetta, what I may term my good leg, and I'm still got some doubts as to which was which leg, left or right. But anyway, my good leg was really good. My left, my presumably was a bad one, but was a bit better, and I could shuffle along as long as I had a staff, use that walking stick and a staff and a hold on to a thing. Now they were still making the airstrip, and of course in those days they were airstrips. There was no such thing as an airfield in a normal sense. They would use old abandoned vegetable gardens because they'd been levelled and flat. And so they were landing DC-3s on these little airstrips. And all I was told was that they were taking walking wounded. So officially I became walking wounded. So anyway, I clambered up, and because I think it's only about 2 to 3 steps on the DC-3, and so I got inside the plane and got down to Port Moresby and into hospital. And then, well, I don't know how much was good luck or how much was skill, but anyway, the doctors got me right there, because how on earth they sorted out the damaged parts of the brain, because I'm still left with, well, the long-term affliction, for what it's worth, is a loss of a degree of taste and smell. And that's it. But it always took me months and months before I came good. I was put on a hospital ship, the Centaur, which was sunk later by the Japs. Fortunately not on the on my trip down to Brisbane. I got to Brisbane, immediately taken from the boat to a railway, and just an ordinary setting up seats, just simply railway carriages. Off we went to Sydney. Now, things were rough and ready, and you couldn't have got more haphazard than what was going on in those days, really, than that. But that was a troop train, which became a hospital train, but it had no more facilities than if it was an ice cream cart.
Effectively, though, your war was over.
Oh, my word, yes.
And you were discharged 3rd of October 1943.
What was the date?
3rd of October 1943.
Oh, right. Look, some of those things are not emblazoned in my mind. So 3rd of October, I'll have to remember that one.
And you were back on Civvy Street?
Oh, crikey. I was a mess. I really was. And anyway, my old firm came and chased me up, and they wanted a pair of hands, and even my brain wasn't working fully at that time. It would have been enough as a body. What pension I was given was impossible to live on. It was, look, I can't tell you, except in my feeling of, disquiet, that's putting it very gentlemanly, my feeling. Basically, I should say disgust. Well, here it was. I was just simply a matter. An unemployed person, when the world was screaming out for people to be employed.
You came back to Australia, you recovered, and you've told me that you lost some sense of taste and smell, but you found work, you had a family. Was it all worth it? If you look back on it now, Bert, was your military service the incredible survival and your powers of survival that you had to draw upon, the wound, was it worth it now looking back on it? What are your sentiments on that score?
Oh, you couldn't measure the worth of it because I had to do it as a citizen of Australia. Now, although it was expected of me, I expected it of myself. Now, that's the crux of the matter. It applied with so many people. Now, they will talk to you, well, the people were interested to get away from the score of the Great Depression years and the circumstances post-war, World War I. And as far as I was concerned, I had an obligation, and this is how I think most others in the same category would have considered it, had an obligation to do something for your country.
World War II in words was made possible through a grant from the Anzac Day Commemoration Fund, Government of South Australia, with support by the RSL South Australia, the Vietnam Veterans Association and the Vietnam Veterans Federation. Research assistance from the Australian War Memorial, the RSL South Australia Virtual War Memorial and the Narratives of War Research Group, University of South Australia. Specialised help by Peter Collins, Christina Lake, Bob Plummer, Jeff Locke and Adele Andrews. Editing by Shane McCarthy, University of South Australia, with technical support by Andre Garston and Justin McGuinness, University of South Australia. Interviewer and narrator, Nigel Stark. Executive producer, Lieutenant Colonel Bill Denny.